And welcome, 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 dear listeners, wherever you find yourself. Welcome to this particular Tuesday morning session here on your number one talk radio station. And as always, specifically welcoming you to the particular early morning scoop session that obviously runs from now, 6 a.m. Well, that's a few minutes past 6 a.m. all the way up until 8 a.m. here on your number one talk radio station. That's obviously as a lot of you are in the midst and the motions of commuting, as well as also potentially dropping off school kids. And obviously, you know, in terms of your drive time session, welcome once again. I do actually hope that you've at least had a cup of coffee. Mine is slightly far away from me. I've actually forgot it. And ultimately that you're, you know, looking forward to the new day, specifically in our company and towards the rest of your own particular goals, as well as also the goings about in terms of your own engagements. Now, as we always do, specifically do look forward to this morning's particular session of the Early Morning Scoop, where we'll be looking into the aspect of market development specifically. That's obviously for small producers and the importance of gaining access to a market. And secondly, looking at the recently launched aspect of the recently launched AI readiness report, which is a specific pivotal indication and which will highlight many particular talking points coming through on this morning's session. And also getting into insights. Specifically, we've got at the end of that, insights coming through from taking a look at from a civil society perspective. And secondly, speaking to everyday individuals, for example, like that of getting the insights from a learner on school. I actually promised the young gentleman, you know, I won't identify him that much. We'll just stick to the basic identification that we did. However, the insights coming through from teenagers and youngsters who are deemed as the future, and in terms of who are best positioned in the future, in terms of future labor force, future professionals, future particular, industrial and economic practices that they will be engaging in, utilizing the everyday use of the artificial intelligence components. We get some insight from a said particular teenager. At least he's 18 years old, guys. Don't worry. It's not a complete minor. It's an 18 years old young gentleman who will obviously give his interactions and have a discussion with us. And that's obviously at the back end of the overall discussion that we will have in terms of analyses after you heard all the particular furor and fanfare regarding the readiness report. Now, as always, dear listeners, we start off firstly with the international news segment, which obviously gets us into the particular scenario of understanding what's happening around the world and ultimately what have been some of the particular developments in the meantime that you probably and I have, you know, had a little bit of shut eye between last night and up until now. Stepping specifically into a discussion in the African context, where the threat of famine and its particular spread throughout the Sudan area, as Sudan is looking at a potentially 25 million people that are acutely food insecure, and that is according to the World Health Organization. This is as malnutrition has killed at least 63 people in the country, mostly women and children, in just 1 week in Sudan's besieged city of El Fasher. And this is as a senior health official indicated there, that as the fighting between the army and the rival paramilitary organization intensifies in the western region of the country. We have a listen to this report.
Malnutrition has killed 63 people, mostly women and children, in the past week in the besieged city of El Fasher, as fighting between the army and rival paramilitaries intensifies in the western Darfur region, with the situation expected to worsen as food insecurity takes hold. El Fasher is the last major urban centre in Darfur in the hands of the army. And for more on this mounting food crisis, we can go to Kenya, where our regional correspondent Bastien Henry is standing by. Good morning, Bastien. 25 million people in Sudan, or half of the country, are in a situation of food insecurity. And this is a direct result of the conflict.
Absolutely. And the situation depends on where you are in Sudan. If you're in the eastern or northern part of the country, areas that are under the control of the Sudanese military and that are not affected directly by the war, if you have money, you can find food. But the more you get closer to the front line, the more difficult it becomes. Let's say around Khartoum, as an example, restaurants are open. It's possible to find food, but many people cannot afford it. So in February, I was in a hospital for children, malnourished children in the suburbs of Khartoum, and it was full of kids. And then it gets even worse if you get into RSF territories. There, it's very difficult for humanitarian assistance to reach these areas. Many crops have been destroyed. And it's even worse in El Fasher, the city that you mentioned, the capital of...
We come back right after the short ad break. Coming up right now.
At ShopRite, we're celebrating 35 years of lower prices with unbeatable deals. Let's mark the occasion with savings on essentials like 2 kg Real Good Chicken, frozen mixed chicken portions for just $89.99. 2 kg King White Sugar, only $39.99. Valid until 17 August 2025. Don't miss out on these deals. ShopRite, lower prices you can trust, always. Stand to win your groceries for free at ShopRite. Buy any 3 participating products. Find the unique code on your till slip. WhatsApp it to us and see if you're a winner. Plus, there are instant daily prizes to be won. Only at ShopRite.
Coming back there from the quick break right there. And we step back into the ad break, into the report, apologies, where we left off.
North Darfur, still under the control of the Sudanese military, but this city has been besieged by the rapid support forces since April 2024. It's impossible to bring humanitarian assistance in the city. In June, the World Food Program tried to bring a convoy inside the city. Trucks were destroyed and at least 5 men were killed. I was on the phone last week with a resident of El Fasher, and he told me that it's not possible to buy food anymore, even if you have money, that many people had to eat cattle feed in order to survive. And he says that it's not the only issue in the city. He told me that, of course, there is a cholera outbreak in Darfur at the moment, but also that civilians are being bombed by the rapid support forces every day in El Fasher. So I asked him how he would describe the situation in El Fasher, and he told me that there is just one word that can be used: hell.
Now, El Fasher has been besieged since April 2024, and the Sudanese military recently repelled a major offensive in which foreign mercenaries, including Colombian ones, are said to have taken part. Well, what more can you tell us about this?
Well, we've been aware of the presence, the involvement of foreign mercenaries since December last year. At that time, Colombian mercenaries were bringing weapons from Libya into Sudan. More recently, they've been training RSF recruits and drone pilots. And in the latest development, according to the Sudanese military, some of them are even fighting around El Fasher. The army said that it killed several Colombian mercenaries last week, even though it's impossible to independently verify this allegation. Also, last week, the Sudanese military said that it destroyed a plane that was landing in Niala Airport. Niala is a big city controlled by the rapid support forces. The Sudanese military say that the plane was belonging to the United Arab Emirates and that it was carrying weapons and at least 40 Colombian mercenaries, that they were all killed. So it's also impossible to verify this allegation. Both the rapid support forces and the UAE denied the information. Rapid support forces say that they do not hire foreign mercenaries, and the UAE say they're not involved in the war in Sudan.
Now, stepping over into a specifically international component, and this is taking a look at a global aspect in terms of the notion of the global economy and the balance of the future in terms of humanity. Now, this is obviously, as the United Nations, one of its own particular programs, the sub, if we can call it sub pillars of agencies, The UNFPA came out with its recent global population report in terms of where this particular report stands in terms of what some of the particular pressures are. We take a listen in terms of what some of these particular insights are that stem from this particular report.
Population, but one that's getting older. It's a trend that's likely to have profound consequences for the global economy. And it comes too as governments are racking up huge debts that will be left to future generations to pay off. So what does it all mean for how we live? Well, overall, the global population is still growing. The UN is forecasting that it'll peak at 10.3 billion by the mid-2080s. But in many advanced economies, it's falling, with birth rates below the 2.1 children needed to keep a population stable. Why? Well, a major UN study found that 39% of people said financial limitations were the main reason for having fewer children. In the UK, the decline in birth rates is typical of other advanced economies, and the average birth rate here is 1.5 children. Now, these people have been explaining some of the reasons behind that trend.
When we had Alex, who's 3 now, we always thought once he qualifies for his funded childcare, which is from January next year, that we would possibly then think about expanding our family, having another baby. However, if we did that next year, then we would possibly be into paying childcare fees for 2 children at the time that our remortgage is up.
Nursery prices and food prices and other stuff is just, all things are just getting high in price. So it's just diminishing the chance for you to have second child.
I came out of med school with a lot of debt. At this moment in time, I don't think I could start a family on this wage at all. I'm a little bit older and it pains me that I have to wait.
And there are similar challenges around the world. Before being overtaken by India, China was a country that got a lot richer off the back of having the world's biggest population for most of the last quarter century. Those people have powered the labour force in factories churning out Chinese-made goods sold to the rest of the world. But Xi Jinping's government is concerned about sustaining that economic growth, so recently said it will give parents $500 a year for each child under the age of 3, to help with costs. Here's what some parents in Beijing make of that plan.
For young couples who just got married and already have a baby, this might encourage them to have a second child. It will help ease the burden and offer some reassurance.
I think this is a good thing. Raising a child is costly, right? Education and all the other things. Compared to my generation, the costs have definitely increased. That includes food, education, healthcare, and all the basics.
Childcare subsidies can solve some of the short-term problems, but more importantly, in the long term, there are other issues such as who will take care of the children.
Well, it took just 11 years for the global population to grow from 7 billion in 2011 to 8 billion by 2022. Better health, nutrition and medicine have prolonged how long we live, but that also costs money, and it's also getting more expensive to support a child. Research from the UN Population Fund found that economic barriers were the biggest reason for millions of people choosing to have fewer children. So I've been speaking to one of its senior leaders who's been tackling these challenges around the world for more than 30 years. Alana Armitage, welcome to Talking Business. Now, I know there's a lot of research been done into what the future of our global population looks like. You've got one called the State of the World Population Report, and it particularly looks at some of the issues around how people view their future when it comes to children. What does that report tell us? What does that research give us an insight into?
I think what's really exciting about this year's State of the World Population Report, which is called The Real Fertility Crisis, is that we're understanding that people's very personal decisions about wanting to have a child are actually directly related to how they see the global economy. So I think the big challenge for business, for governments, really is understanding that this is about our future human capital, right? So our study actually showed that one of the biggest reasons why young people today are finding it difficult to have the number of children they'd like to have is mainly for economic causes. So we actually interviewed 14,000 people in 14 different countries, and one in five said that they did not think that they would be able to have the number of children they wanted to have. And the 50% of those reported that the reason was financial precarity, economic precarity, whether that is lack of housing, whether that's job insecurity, or whether that is lack of affordable childcare. So what we are finding in UNFPA is that the real fertility crisis, it's not a crisis of people not wanting to have children. The crisis is really the gap between the desire to have children and what people feel they can actually achieve in today's economy.
So clearly on a family level, on a personal level, that is a huge decision for people to make. But talk to me about the wider implications here, because it strikes me that there has been, up until now maybe, a social contract between generations, one that says a younger generation will be at work and pay for a older generation that has retired. And given the squeeze on incomes, fewer people coming into the workforce, that contract has utterly broken down, hasn't it?
You know, I think this is the biggest question for United Nations Population Fund. This is what is causing the greatest anxiety at the moment. And we're seeing that already in Europe, in Asia, where in many countries, 30% of the population is already over 65. So definitely this is a big issue. However, one thing that I think is really important to keep in mind is that this is not happening overnight. You know, this transition of age structures is actually something that we can plan for. Because if you see today, the 10 largest economies of the world, they all have below replacement fertility. So we need a new social contract. If we look at the way that our systems have been built, the models that we continue to have around pensions, education, health, they were pretty much built, you know, over 50 years ago, in a sense, when people lived 30 years less. So we really need to radically rethink the way we are promoting these policies. We need an intergenerational social contract that reflects the demographic future that we're going to live in, that reflects the modern economy and the way it works.
What does that look like, though? Because in China's case, for example, the government there is suggesting they will make payments for people who have more kids. It's not as simple as just everybody having more children, is it?
So what we need is not short-term incentives, but rather long-term investment. And nothing is wrong with providing these baby bonuses. But interestingly, if you look at the case of Norway and Sweden, they are two countries that have pretty good family policies, right? And what they have found is that their family policies were actually not addressing all the determinants to why people couldn't have the number of children they want. So that includes things like housing. And if you look across Europe, this is a huge issue, especially in Southern Europe, where fertility rates are so low. Also the issue of the pressure that parents are feeling to be sort of perfect parents. We do need a new social contract, one that's intergenerational, one that actually supports the ecosystem for the whole ecosystem for the family and not just these one-off payments.
But at the same time, we're told that, you know, demand for the world's natural resources will be under more pressure than ever, be that water, food or other resource. And so what is the right strategy to take? Because on one hand, you need to keep the birth rate up to support the economy. On the other hand, though, we're all very conscious of the pressure that's putting on the world.
What is interesting is our report found that one in five people surveyed indicate that climate anxiety is actually keeping them from having the number of children that they'd like to have. So the climate anxiety is a big factor in today's situation of young people not having the number of children they'd like to have. Having said that, we know that fertility itself is not directly linked to climate change. It's the consumption patterns that we need to look at. So many of the wealthier countries with low fertility are those that are most contributing to climate change.
Yeah, and therefore that in itself is a problem for government policy, but also for how we measure the success of an economy. I wonder too whether we need to be thinking about how we measure success in an economy and whether GDP is the right way of doing so, because that, as we've discussed, relies on a growing workforce producing ever more output.
Right. I mean, I think that's the key question, and especially for your show. Again, it is so interesting to see that the UNFPA report is really showing that these very personal decisions really reflect the health of the economy. It signals what's going on in the global economy, and it also signals that perhaps we need to look at different indicators. We certainly cannot be promoting any ideal population size or ideal population composition or any ideal fertility rate. We've seen in the past what that actually does to people. It's a demographic engineering is always harmful.
And that does bring us up to the end of the international news segment, dear listeners, here on your number one talk radio station. This is the Early Morning Scoop. We'll quickly be stepping into a short break, and after that, we'll be jumping into the local news segment, specifically getting into some of the insightful features regarding the developments, as well as also some of the particular talking points as mentioned earlier. For specifically starting off with that for the organic farming and gaining access to a market in terms of all the particular insights coming through from the various producers from a recent conference this morning.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Coming back there from the short break and welcoming you to into what will be the next 1 hour, 30 minutes in terms of taking a look at local developments happening here in the country. Now, do remember, dear listeners, in terms of just jogging your memory and ultimately just reminding you specifically that tomorrow is Wednesday, and that obviously means that today, Tuesday, is the Villager e-paper eve in terms of you being able to anticipate the latest edition to come out tomorrow. Or tomorrow morning, if you have not become a subscriber with us as yet, I don't know where you've been specifically, because all you've got to do is just drop us a text message on WhatsApp to the number 081-200-4144. It's free of charge, don't worry. Okay, but it's not technically free of charge. It's you and your service provider in terms of your data, you know, your data bundles. And all you've got to do is just text there, subscribe. Remember to save the number so that it does not look like we are spamming you uncontrollably in terms with updates, as well as also bringing you insightful reads, as well as also other particular updates happening around the country. But rather just to tell you, hey, listen, here's a detailed particular insight in terms of one of the particular subject matter happening currently in the country. Now, stepping into just giving you, if you've missed the Monday edition, yes. If you've missed the Monday edition specifically of the e-paper, that obviously was the 11th of August, that being yesterday, do remember there is awesome particular content in terms of on the front page, the lead story about Namibia only being able to generate 54% of its own power in June. That's a very insightful discussion specifically in terms of in light of the NDP6 that was recently launched and its particular detailed view in terms of the various needs that Namibia has. A second scenario obviously is taking a look, and that's obviously paging on from, you know, from page one to page two of the e-paper. I'm just going to give you a quick skim in terms of what you potentially missed back then. Because in every edition of the e-paper, we not only keep it unique, but we also give you insightful reporting in terms of taking a look at some of the particular developments coming through. There's obviously the skepticism from artists or the arts and culture sector in Namibia. And that's specifically bordering on the human development pillar. which is the last pillar from the NDP6, and in terms of how arts and culture can play a pivotal role in economic upliftment as well as also economic diversity in the country. Another one particularly is taking a look at the third page analysis specifically coming through there from my colleague Loise in terms of the school Twapandula PS that receives at least $300,000 for a classroom. Insightful developments, obviously, because that also forms part of the human development pillar in if you're looking at an overall socioeconomic development. Then there's the aspect of 100 new boreholes that are planned to be drilled in Oshikoto, which all speaks towards, you know, the improvement of livelihoods as well as also the maintenance of particular development mechanisms for the broader society. So just giving you a quick rundown there in terms of the development, obviously, that kicks through. At the end of the e-paper, there is an insightful opinion piece there. I myself also have to, you know, start getting into the opinion piece contributions for the e-paper. But you can have a look there specifically at what my colleague Kanjingo himself highlights there. If you've ever wondered what the man looks like, the man, the mystery, the myth, you can have a look there at the slightly distorted video that he, not video, picture, photo, sorry guys, that he used there specifically for his opinion piece. The one cited as so many engagements, consultations, but I hope we are engaging. And that ultimately just giving you a quick overview specifically of what you can find in yesterday, even that being Monday. Oh yes, and there's obviously also some lovely ads there, specifically one there about specials lasting a good time frame. Have a look. You'll be able to find a good reading there. Now getting into where we were meant to also start off in terms of the local news aspect, we start off specifically with taking a look at an organic farming conference in Windhoek that looked into the unique aspects of producers of organic fresh produce and other organic farming products in relation to how they accessed markets and what they learned in terms of developing their own projects or even the broader impact that they had on surrounding communities. We head firstly to the south of the country, specifically where the idea to convert from livestock farming to self-sufficiency indicated the necessity or the necessary turnaround for farmers and rural communities around the town of Maltahir. We have a listen to what Marika Raves from the Rural Revive Initiative outlines the specific reasons were for going in this direction of becoming a food secure community.
I feel really disconnected where I'm standing today with all the work which is done in organic agriculture in the north of Namibia, but somewhere you would have to start. And I am, America Rawis, and I was one of the founding persons with Stefan Brookman to start this initiative in the south, which is called Full Revive. And maybe we can get my presentation going. It's also not needed. So during COVID, we actually sat down and say there is a lot which can happen if you have a local market. And you have a lot of niche products which is produced by farmers. And we really sit down and look at different things. And being in the tourism industry for most of my life and that I'm really a passionate farmer, we came up with Rural Revive. So Rural Revive is a project which we conceptuated under Volga Dance Foundation and the Volga Dance Foundation for the Volga Dance Vision 2030. And it's actually just what we would have looked at, what we do for the community of the closest community close to a tourism sector. And is there a press button? Okay, yeah. So if you look at this whole matrix of the African Eden, of the Arid Eden project of the Volga Dance Foundation, Rural Revive is just a small little block there. But we sure we can carry, is there a clicker? Yeah. So we quickly realized that looking at the community and setting up economic circle in a community, this is something which we have to give its own identity and its own space. So we really conceptualized Rural Revive around, and now today it's registered as a Section 21. But we started it by looking at Maldia and what it can offer. So it's Maldia is the closest community to, or the closest village to, if you look at all those lodges laying around Cesarean, so the sources play interest. And it was very soon that we realized that we have to see that people produce something which they, and which is in a need for the lodges. So horticulture was, you can carry on with it. Yeah. I don't want to spend a lot of time on how we really put it all right together, but rather just go to horticulture. So we soon realized if we want to find a niche for a market which is close to us, you look at horticulture. Because if you operate a place, so you can just stand for me at that ripple effect, it's fine. Yeah. So if you find a place for a niche market like that, Sausage Play, we did a research, and we find that you have more than 2,500 beds. And I don't even want to say in a radius around Sausage Play, because it's not a full radius, it's only really like 180 degree radius, as it's the right side of its only visit. So there's a huge market in this tourism growth. So we've started looking at how are we going to encourage economic growth, and horticulture was really like the first thing, but because you have all the farmers in the area, and we never really looked at horticulture itself. It was always just like sheep farming, cattle farming, and all those things, and nobody really realized that you can produce food around it. But in my time when I was basically where Lydia is now, but only in the south, I was working for GIZ and as advisor for the farmers, and we see that each and every farmer actually do have a small garden, and you have lots of neglected farm fruit trees or old gardens which is just not taken care of. So we take up this thing, and I remember Lydia when she walked in with me when we started working out in Maldia as Mrs. Organic and Mrs. Organic Material, and we were looking at each other and saying, okay, we stand on this heaps of dung, animal sheep dung and everything, but we don't have organic material. And she just said, we're making compost, we're going to do compost. And we really started very, very small. And if we carry on to the work packages of the Revive, you will see that the first work package, so this is just our nine fields.
Now, citing the particular importance of finding the necessary inputs for the organic material for the gardening projects, Rav has indicated that there have been surprising results, for example, like the exciting prospect of growing your own sugar cane. And this is obviously something in terms of their own particular proof of testimony in terms of the unique insights in terms of the possibilities of whichever particular crop can be produced in the particular desired locations across the country.
Of engagement in the community, but horticulture is the one we're concentrating on. You will see that the first work package was laundry, and we went and say, okay, we're doing the laundry for lodges, and that wastewater we're going to use just to produce organic material. And if you want to believe it or not, we are growing sugarcane. And just with the recycled water from the laundry, and the sugarcane is our green organic material where we start our compost with. And we really started focusing on small backyard gardens, helping the resettlement farmers to just start making their own gardens. And I am so far from it to say that we are organically farming, but we are on our way there, because we don't, you can't go chemical in a community environment. You're looking at people which are selling chicks or a one-bedroom house, so you're definitely not going to introduce chemical stuff there.
obviously we still have a long, long way to go if it comes to that we are not using, or that we are using organic seeds and all those things, but at least we know where we are going to. So but we are here for the market today, so I didn't want to really talk about the production side. So for the market, I think I'm so nervous because 7 minutes is a very short. for the market, we focus and say, okay, from the revive side, we are going to set up a barn, so a place where people can bring all their produce, and in the barn, the main focus is to teach people. So we set up the whole Rory Bike campus, which we registered it with the Appenori board, and the barn is like a small fresh produce hub. So they bring in the produce, we help them there to sort out market related products and say, okay, this is what we can pack and this is what we cannot pack. And we really encourage that on the market side of training people there, when you should harvest your product, that it's going to last. But we sit with a lot of advantages because...
Who are we, you ask? The National Road Safety Council is a statutory body established in 1996 with a legal mandate to promote and manage road safety across Namibia. We believe every accident is preventable and every life is precious. Our mission is to make our roads, vehicles, and users safer based on effective road safety management. So, join our unwavering vision and commitment to zero deaths and serious injuries. Visit www.nisc.org.na to learn more. Do the right thing and save lives.
But we sit with a lot of advantages because being so close to our market and having a niche market, we are literally 150 kilometers away from the furthest lodge. So we can actually, I am now supplying fresh herbs and salads to the lodges, and you can't believe it, there is no big worry about how long it's traveling, because since it's harvest in the morning till it reaches the lodge, you have a maximum of 6 hours. And this is the big thing of looking at your market. I think we deteriorated our soils, our land, for so many times thinking we have to produce one exceptional product, as also coming from a commercial farmer's idea, exceptional product which we are exporting. And we are exporting everything, because if you export that land to be sorted, I don't know where, and take away an inventory from the south, you are taking all the organic products, so all the what we need to go back into the soil away. And here we can start producing small, 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 but we are really re-innovating our soil there where we are. So we don't have to look for these massive export markets where a lot of product goes to waste because of the transport. So just by starting small, we are really growing slowly but surely. So this hub where I focused on the tourism market in the beginning, actually in the last 3 years, had a lot of positive impact on my community. Things which I never knew is going to happen because I think I was too much business orientated. And it's unbelievable. So I was just explaining to Lydia where we started in the beginning, setting up for people a 6 by 6 meter little garden in their back garden, and we were faced with they don't have a water connection, they don't know the practices of gardening, blah, blah, blah. I am already there today where we broke it down and we partnered with I forgot the name, but we're doing food circles. So if somebody is coming to us today and saying they would like to start gardening, we just start with a round diameter of 1 meter and learning them all the permaculture processes of gardening. And this is how they grow. If they manage 3 of these food circles and they've got through 6 fruit trees, then we go to a bigger one. So this is the big thing of what I wanted to bring rural life across is we shouldn't look for the export market or go and find the market there, and also look at what we are putting back into our community, because I think malnutrition is something which is slowly deteriorating in my community because there is more smarter people, which is just having a backyard of it. And
coming back there specifically from the first particular insight in terms of developing a sustainable food secure and thus also gaining a market secure particular strategy. The insights there obviously from Marika Ravis in terms of looking into the impact of firstly establishing what you need to do specifically as well as also achieving a notion in terms of where and to who to sell. This obviously then leads us into the second particular aspect in terms of Bettina Meyerhofer, who hails from the green market Windhoek here in Namibia, or here in the capital specifically, who explained during her particular session of how having a market for organic growers actually outlines the importance of providing goods to clients who are willing to consume and regularly purchase the goods on sale at these particular kinds of markets, as well as also aim to promote and present organically grown and supplied goods in that scenario. Let's have a listen to what she outlined.
And that is how the green market look like. But I would like to start with general building up our confidence in what we are in the food market in general. The journey begins with the production, and most of you are producers, or the production farmers, and then it comes to the market. Many of you grow livestock, fresh vegetables, herbs, and after the harvest is always the question, where do we sell it now? And what we all need is a market, and we need buyers. And some buyers you find in procurement markets, they need your raw material to manufacture something, and some are in the direct sales markets. That are supermarkets, and there's also a high potential for local grown food, and also in private selling groups, to lodges, or in open air markets. Yeah? But in all markets, it's the same principle. Supply must meet the demand, and products must meet the customers, and the producer must be paid. And when we look at the market we all are in, we see it's big, competitive, and it's essential. Of course, beside water, food is the only second one thing we human beings need to survive. And the global food market is massive. It's the largest consumer market on Earth. We have 8.2 million people that are our clients. Households, they spend 50% in higher income groups, up to 50% of their monthly income on food. And food is not bought once, it's bought weekly or on a daily basis. And there are big global players. But we have with our customers a shift in the awareness, the rise of conscious consumers, and that we have to be very much aware with what we do, because our market is very big. Yeah? Each year the awareness is rising of that the customers are asking, where is the food coming from? How was it produced? Is it local? Is it healthy? And how was it grown or processed? We see all over the world an increase in health-focused diet, in more people use food as a medicine, and a high demand from the clients for transparent, sustainable, and ethical farming. Okay, the Namibian food market is unfortunately not 8.3 billion people, but we have 3 million customers, and they want to eat every day. still, I think we import too much food. If you see in the supermarkets all over, we import a lot. And I think we have the potential, we have fertile grounds, and we have a long-term farming history and tradition. That is, Namibia is a land of farmers. And there's potential, both literally and also economically, for expanding our thriving for a local food economy. And that, I think, is also the success of the green market. The green market exists since over 20 years. I took over 7 years ago. And when we started 20 years ago, we had four stalls, like Okahania Organics, Krumuk. They were exhibiting their products. But nowadays, you find every Saturday 45 stallholders with their local produce selling direct to the customers. And the surrounding of the market is in a green environment, it's under the open sky. We have the highest density of big supermarkets in Windhoek, and still we got a lot of clients visiting every Saturday's market. Yeah? We built a diversity in our clients, what started 20 years ago with a few European influence clients is now all over every tribe in Namibia, about internationals, experts and tourists, and they come for local, healthy, grown produce. And we have not only a huge diversity of stallholders, yeah? Most of them are coming close from Windhoek, like you also said, it's sometimes a logistic challenge to come from deepest south, from Malta to the market and selling. But we also have resellers, they collect the produce and sell it for the farmers. Yeah? What we focus is also on marketing, yeah? To show through social media what we are doing and what are the clients finding with us. And what we see is also very important. It's not like in a supermarket. You go at the market direct in the communication to the farmer, to the producer. And also for all our clients, it's important to meet the green community of Windhoek.
Now, looking into the specific model for a market of this particular nature, which serves a niche consumer needs, Meyerhofer notes that the current system is actually based on being non-profit for the small producers to have a chance of getting into a space for being able to sell to consumers. We have a listen to what she adds.
Our model in general, our structure is we are a non-profit organization. We are run every Saturday by a dedicated team and with one full-time manager. Our stallholders are small farmers to private producers, own gardens. We have creatives, artists, and small entrepreneurs. Previously, we worked on the market that every stallholder has to pay us 50% of their turnover, and now we changed it to fixed stall fees. And the market also has a fundraising cafe run by local charity and community projects to raise money for their organizations. Our market turnover has increased every year from 5 to 20% over the last 20 years, especially after COVID. And we are regularly getting asked from other customers from other cities to deliver products to their location. And this is a testament to the strong demand of green, local and natural produce. And why open-air local markets work and will always work, and you also see that in the big supermarkets. They need more marketing of local produce to make their supermarkets attractive. And we are believing that is a consistency. Every Saturday, we deliver the same trusted experience. It's also marketing and visibility. We tell real stories about real people, farmers and products. It's a transparency and trust, and that is what the clients are looking for. The direct contact between buyer and producer. And it's also the social connection. People enjoy a human interaction with farmers and with other clients in the community. And it's sustainable. Like also the speaker before me, it's less packaging and it's less footprints. And also, sometimes we believe organic is more, or natural, net, or local is more expensive, but that isn't true. The health aspect will always support the local farming and also the natural farming. Pesticide-free, nutrient-rich, fresh, and full of life. And the local economy support gets more and more important. The money circulates in our own country. And we have a cultural shift. We are going back to the roots. Because supermarkets come from local.
Hello Namibia. The NSA is conducting the Household Income and Expenditure Main Survey from the 28th of April 2025 to the 22nd of April 2026. Our officials in NSA uniforms, IDs and branded vehicles will visit selected households in all 14 regions. Hashtag Your Data Matters.
Supermarkets come from local markets. And there is this global trend, and it's very strong, that local, sustainable, handmade and organic, that is the future of food. Okay, 1 minute, or half a minute. As the future is now, and we should continue to grow local food. And we see it makes so much joy to sell local food in Namibia, and I think everyone has potential markets in every supermarket with their product, because our customers are really looking for natural, organic, grown, local food. Thank you so much.
Now, getting into the final component of this particular feature this morning, as we obviously just moved past the 7 a.m. mark, and this is obviously welcoming you into the last hour of this morning's particular engagement here on the EMS, that being the Early Morning Scoop. And obviously, you've been in our company ever since 6 a.m. That's if you woke up literally at 6 a.m. If you've been awake before then, hopefully you've had a cup of coffee or something warm in you in terms of just getting you ready for the motions of the day. But finally, we turn to Hanyulul from the Aiwa Forest Farm, which is a unique particular venture in that it aims to be the first known agroforestry project of the country by using depleted Mahangu plantation soil in the Kavango West to achieve goals of organically producing goods and the opportunity of preserving soils and helping the natural environment around the project. Now, noting that the start of his project was actually a difficult process, which indicated the idea of the organic pathway that had to be followed, we take a listen to what he adds on in terms of his particular insights in the gaining access to a market, as well as also having the opportunity in terms of where you need to start from, as well as also the aspect of market research.
I was invited to talk about markets in Namibia, and I'm very glad to see what came before me. I love the Rural Revive project, the green market, and now I can see we finally have an online platform for progress, so you can expect me setting up a stall there ASAP. Because one of the things that we have experienced at AWA is that I think most Namibian farmers experience, which is we are very far from the market, and that's always an issue. And delivering what we produce, because that is one side of it, to actually the people that need it and want it, is the whole thing that we need to solve in the country to actually be successful. So we can please go to the next slide. I had this in my previous presentation. Basically, I'm not even sure I'm qualified to speak on this topic, because we are not quite successful yet in this whole thing. Probably some of the farmers like Deer that have done this for 20 years are much more qualified. But I think I can see on the unique experiences and issues we've had these past 2.5 years and maybe some of the solutions we've come up with. So what you can see here is a broccoli field in Kabango West. Let me go to the next slide. I'll tell you more about the broccoli field in a minute. I was also asked to talk about what makes a successful farm. Not all of us are farmers, so I'll kind of try and keep it short. But a lot of people think it's very, very capital intensive, which it is. But more importantly, it needs experience. So I think before you start a farm, you go out and you work for someone, you work with someone, you try and first learn and see what makes sense. Because a lot of people just start and then a year or two or five later, they end up with huge debt and then that just depletes someone that could be a valuable farmer for us. So that's always my first point, is to get the experience somewhere before you start. And then the next one is your time leverage. So how much time do you actually have available to yourself? How much time can you maybe use to train other Namibians on the ground to implement for you while you work on your business and not in your business the whole time? So it's super important to also train others to assist you, because we have a very big labor force in Namibia, a lot of people that are untrained. But you can, if you really invest those hours, people are willing and they're easily built up. So by now we've built up a team in Kabango, and by the time we came there, no one knew nothing about vegetables, really. People there are farmers and usually former hunters, but growing vegetables under irrigation, it was a big question mark. And now there's people, they take so much interest and they even educate me back. They found out things that I didn't know about. So it's really about investing the time into your team, building up your team. Then only comes consideration for me for finances, which is personal finances. How far can you go with those? Your bank loans, which I would be very careful about as a farmer, because as we know at the moment, bank loans have an interest rate, I think it's above 10% or something. Very challenging to do unless you really know what you do. So I would encourage not to do that. Start with what you have. We've heard it a few times today. Start small. That's also what we encourage with our agroforestry systems. You see those big fields, but we actually have a test site that's 50 by 15 meters, which we encourage people to start with. Do that at your homestead. Do that on your farm first. Then go from there, and then go bigger. And I want to shortly talk about funding. So we have, luckily, in Namibia, a lot of funding opportunities. From outside of the country and within the country. So I think for an emerging farmer, there is a lot of opportunity there. People just get discouraged because they go there and they are being turned away because they don't have anything to show yet. That's often the issue with these types of things. Start something small, then go with your project and your learnings and seek funding, and you will be helped. You will be helped. So that is also one thing, probably a few have asked me now about our project that I showed, which is, do you have funding for it? We didn't at the start. We tried, we didn't receive any. We started with really, basically, I can be transparent here, a few 10,000s in the bank account, and that was it, a bucky, and then a few tools, and that's how we went up there. So we lived the first 1.5 years in a tent, we didn't have power, there was no borehole. It was really, really difficult, but we wanted to do it. By the time we had something to show, people were interested in helping us. Now we are helped. Now we can grow further.
He then also goes on to note the basics of, in terms of getting into agriculture, is always to be wary of the market research component that is essential to being able to achieve return on investment for the inputs that were committed to at the start of the growing period. We have a listen to what he adds on.
We have received funding from different entities, especially from European entities, to make this into a bigger project. But it's about the starting that I want to kind of hammer down. Just begin with something small, try yourself, and then show. The next point is the physical. So only that is my last consideration. How much land do you have, your vehicles for transport, your irrigation materials, and then planting materials are important. So that comes last for me, the hiring. Now we can move on to simple market testing and scouting. Something I have learned that I have not done before, which you'll hear about the property story. So, simple market testing, go into your space. Winthrop is a bit easier maybe, but for those of us that are far afield, like us, our nearest market is in Kulungkulu, which doesn't really have an established market. There's a few street stores. If I had gone and I had bought some produce that I wanted to grow and went to the people there and said, do you want to buy this for this amount of price, I would have saved myself a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of headache, because I would have found out very quickly which crops can we grow and which ones shouldn't we grow at the moment for our market. That's something I didn't do. I had lots of assumptions and I had napkin mathematics where, yeah. So do that one to find out if your local market is accepting what you want to give to them. Just buy even a box full of whatever you are trying to sell. It might cost $600 or so, but it will save you probably thousands because it will inform you about what's actually working on the ground and how much can you receive for it. Yeah. And then the last type of thing for a successful farm that I learned over the years is assets versus salary thing. So you have to think as a farmer about your day-to-day costs that you need to cover, your salary, the money that needs to come in every month so you can have a living. But the more important one, which the financial world knows very well, everyone says if you want to become wealthy, invest into assets. As farmers, we should invest into assets. That means things like trees, soil health. Those are things that over the long term can really catapult us into a thriving business and a thriving living condition. Always include them. That's obviously my job as agroforester to promote that, but just include those trees. Local trees, fruit trees, even timber trees. So in our agroforestry field, if I include a timber tree now, in 40 years, 50 years, it will take a long time, but that's my pension. So I have my bank there on my fields, while I'm growing vegetables, while I'm growing fruits. At some point I will go there and I'll have healthy, organic, if you may say, but natural grown timber in a good environment that I can then use and I can reset my fields, for example. So think about those assets. If you have seeds in your fruit plant, then plant those trees around your house, plant them in your fields, include the things so that 10 years down the line or 5 years down the line, your life just becomes easier. Both with income streams, as we see. Also with the longomo nuts, if you think about the next thing with this chickens, like just, you know, think about those multiple income streams in your asset. Okay, we can continue. I'll keep it short. So my personal experience with broccoli and cauliflower, I'm trying to keep it in a few minutes. So you walk into Superspar as a local farmer and you see those broccolis for $65 or $75 and you think, ha, I could grow them. So this is pretty much what goes on in the brain, and then everything else in the brain kind of shuts off. And you sit there on your napkin and you make your calculations on 1 hectare, how much broccoli and cauliflower can I grow? So that field you saw there was a successful broccoli and cauliflower field. It grew about 30,000 broccoli and cauliflower in Kamaba West. Now, I don't know if you've ever been on those street stalls, but there isn't any broccoli and cauliflower. And the reason is people don't eat it, which we found out after we had grown them. And the thing was also they successionally were able to be harvested, so they were all ready at once. Meaning, you would have to take them by the bucky load to a location where people actually want to pay $65 for your property. And then you don't get $65 because the supermarket takes 40 or more, usually. Like, they take a big chunk of what you're getting. So by the time you brought your 10,000 properties and you brought them to Winter, you owe money to the fuel station and wherever you, yeah, whatever you need. So that did not really work out for us. Fortunately, as a side info, people like to eat the leaves of broccoli and cauliflower. So we actually covered our costs by selling those leaves to Angola and the Kabambo West because people used it in their quakies and river. The broccoli heads people didn't even want for free. So vital market information. You know, vital market information, think about that. And we have had similar experiences with other things. So it's really just worth it to try out an error beforehand. Yeah, next slide. Just quickly on the transport aspect, because I know I don't have time. I have a neighbor farmer who is farming conventional vegetables on a larger scale, also up on the river, and he is delivering around the country. We've got empty trucks because the trucks come up to the north, they bring all the food from South Africa or Sunbridge, and they go empty back. For example, ShopRite, SeekRite, those trucks they drive past our farm empty, going back to winter. Now he approached ShopRite and said, can I sell watermelons to you? And they said, yes, we'll take all of your watermelons at a fair price, $45 per watermelon. And we'll take them from your farm, which is a great deal, and you think, okay, I've made it. The issue in Namibia is most of the produce has to go to distribution centers. So for them to enter the distribution center, they need to be in ShopRite's boxes, which he himself has to pay transport for to get to his farm. Then he has to buy the stickers to put on the watermelons. And there's a few other steps included in it. By the time that watermelon actually is in ShopRite, he has only made $8 on the watermelon, which is below production cost, which means no profit on the watermelon. So he planted a whole 2 hectares of watermelons and made actually less than zero money. He had to pay in. All of those extra costs included. So there was produce, it reached the consumer, but the farmer at the end of the day made no money because of the complications behind the whole transport situation. And also because, to be honest, of the big supermarkets not being very helpful.
Are you eligible to vote but not yet a registered voter? Your time is now. Electoral Commission of Namibia invites all qualified citizens to take part in the supplementary registration of voters, which takes place from the 4th until the 19th of August 2025. These include those who turned 18 years after the previous registration of voters, all eligible Namibian citizens who are not yet in possession of a valid voter's card, citizens who have changed residence from one constituency or local authority to a different constituency or local authority. Democracy is not a spectator sport, it's all about taking part. Get involved. Step up for your right. Register to vote.
Supermarkets not being very helpful with this.
Now coming back there specifically in terms of the gaining access to a specific market, what to do in terms of unique contributions and ultimate laws of understanding what kinds of consumers can be attracted in that scenario, it does get us into sort of like switching over into another particular gear. But before we actually do any switching over, we quickly take a short break and we come back right after that.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Getting back there from the quick break, the quick sort of like... if I can say intermission in that scenario. And obviously you find yourself here on your number one talk radio station, that's Eagle FM, and you're listening to the Early Morning Scoop, which ends literally at 8 a.m. Once again, if you've just switched on, if you've just tuned in, if you've just accessed the application specifically of Eagle FM, good morning. Welcome to your particular Tuesday morning broadcasting as well as also session here in our company. And you'll be in my company up until 8 a.m. before I have to hand over to the next program, which will technically be with Mike in terms of crossing over to the Ondangwa studio, where he'll actually be getting into the unpacking of the day for this particular session. However, we still have a good 40 minutes still to go and some particular insights still to engage on. Now we get into the first particular, we get into our, not our first particular, but our first particular contribution based upon our next subject matter, which is obviously the recent launch of the AI readiness report and monitoring report, the AI readiness and monitoring report here in Namibia. that was conducted by the MESAC ministry, the super ministry in, and as well as also one of its affiliate SOEs, that being the NCRST, in collaboration with the UNESCO and the Japanese government. Now, this is as the Deputy Minister Dino Balotti outlined that the direction for the country, which it wishes to take, with the aspect of being able to address some of the particular gaps and the necessary areas of potential indicators that will enable the country to be able to fully adapt and adopt to the role of AI in the country at large. Now, we take a listen to what he actually contributed in that scenario.
I acknowledge you, as well as the former colleagues that wrote on this report. And those colleagues were Professor Peters, Professor Matengu, Professor Naumak, Professor Mawala from the University of Johannesburg, Dr. Martin Davies, then you and I, without any of those fancy titles, and we also had Miss Grace Amakwa. And we were part of that exercise, and I wanted to mention this because I'm informed that you're part of the panel late this morning. And I think it's equally noteworthy to share with everyone the efforts that went into that extensive exercise. So let's give a... Allow me to sincerely thank UNESCO, as well as the dedicated national team that all stood, who tirelessly worked to produce this assessment. We as a country are proud to be among the first African countries to pilot this important initiative, as mentioned by Ms. Smith. Artificial intelligence is often described as the defining technology of our time. It is transforming economies, it is reshaping education, as well as health systems, and it is presenting new ways to address long-standing development challenges. However, artificial intelligence is not always neutral. It reflects the values, the biases, and the priorities of societies that build and deploy it. That is why the UNESCO recommendation on the ethics of artificial intelligence, adopted by 193 member states, including Namibia, in 2021, is so critical. It calls upon us to center AI around human rights, inclusion, transparency, and accountability. This RAM report reflects both the promise as well as the urgency. I am proud to share that Namibia has made commendable progress. We are already investing in digital infrastructure, skills development, and STEM education. Our public universities, as mentioned by the previous speaker, are offering some of these AI-relevant degrees. And I'm going to give NUST their flowers this morning, particularly the bachelor's degree that was mentioned in artificial intelligence, as well as I'm informed with specializations in the Faculty of Computing and Informatics, where we have computational sciences, AI. Sure, 5 or 10 years ago, we would have ever known what that was. And it's funny, because I went back to school in 2019, before COVID, and we didn't have AI when I did my master's. So I really wish that we did. Because I'm currently back in school, and I think it would almost be counterproductive not to use artificial intelligence to add value to what you're trying to do. If you don't know one of the various, and probably thousands of various AIs, there's one called the chat PDF. So what happens now is you throw the PDF in there, you ask it a few questions, and it extracts what you're really looking for. So before, I had highlighters, and I don't think there were any colleagues of mine that... Maybe I don't know if you met in my office, I'm not sure. But I think I wasn't at MPDB that time. But I printed, let's say I used my own printer, please. But we printed these journals, and I assure you it was probably this high with a highlighter, and we looked for, I don't know, the methodology, and we looked. And now, with the use of AI, it just makes our lives so much easier. So as a country, we have passed key pieces of legislation, such as the Access to Information Act of 2022, as well as the Draft Data Protection Bill. And I smile because I know that my honourable member, Honourable Maton, has mentioned this in Parliament, and we really need to expedite this process, and we really need to get this draft on table so that we can execute. In addition, we are developing strategic frameworks in cybersecurity, innovation, and e-governance. But this report also identifies, as mentioned by Dr. Mukoshi, important challenges which we must urgently address. Namibia currently has no dedicated national AI strategy or policy, and this limits our ability to coordinate and govern AI development in a holistic and forward-looking manner. There is also no regulatory framework specific to AI, but I think we need to give our government grace, because we do know how quick AI is evolving. In the space of 12 months, piece of legislation might be very much dated with the new realities of the day. I want to stress that there is a clear need to support AI startups and invest in local innovation ecosystems as well as public-private partnerships. I was very fortunate to attend an event, I think it was probably 2 weeks ago, where local startups in the edutech space presented. It was quite interesting at the cinema. So I think that's a cool venue to have a session with even popcorn and cool drink to drink. And I'm going to mention a few of those startups, and please forgive me if I don't mention all of them. Okaluli, Geni AI, which you may all be familiar with, EduGame, Minds in Action, Genius Robotics, as well as others presented their efforts. And we need to do more to support these startups in country. Let us be clear, our readiness to harness AI will define the trajectory of our future. This report provides important guidance to help shape Namibia's path forward. AI is not just about machines and algorithms, it is about people. It is about ensuring that children in rural areas of the country can also benefit from the adaptive learning platforms, that farmers can access climate-smart data, that healthcare workers can be supported with diagnostic tools, and that our young people can create, innovate, and thrive in this global economy. As I was sitting there quickly putting a few notes together for this speech, I asked AI a very silly question, because this is a message I want to bring across. And so I prompted, how do I make $1,000 today? That was my question. I think the prompt was today, very specific to Namibia, and it's 1,000, right? And so the answers that it gave me, and I said I only want three, I want the top three. And it said the first one, sell something of value that you already own. The second one, offer a high value same day service. And the third one was buy and resell something that is underpriced. And it gave the example of Biltong, AI to Biltong, airtime, and I think it was clothing or secondhand clothes. And I'm almost certain, as mentioned, very few, well, pretty much all of us in the room are using artificial intelligence in some way or form. And I recently caught out someone who said, no, I don't use AI at all. So I said, use Google. They said, yes.
Now, on that particular note as well, we get into the UNESCO representative, Eunice Smith, who added that Namibia stands at a specific point in its own particular destiny, in its developmental path, to adopt new technologies and their potentials as the world is becoming ever more interconnected, and as the advancements are actually multiplying ever more. Let's have a look at what she said.
It is a pleasure because what we're doing today is establishing the foundation to support Namibia to begin building an architecture around artificial intelligence so that it can effectively harness this new but rapidly developing technology to support the country's development. Artificial intelligence has been hailed as an international public good that offers unprecedented opportunities for development and for humanity. However, as we all know, with its unprecedented opportunities, AI also brings unprecedented risks and challenges. This is why UNESCO insists on the ethical aspects of artificial intelligence, emphasizing that artificial intelligence development, governance, and application must be underpinned by values such as respect, protection and promotion of human rights and fundamental freedoms and human dignity, protection and flourishing of the environment and ecosystems. It must ensure diversity and inclusiveness, and it must enable peaceful, just, and interconnected society. The assessment report, which will be formally presented and discussed later today, and which we are launching on Namibia's readiness to embrace artificial intelligence, is one of the monitoring and evaluation tools developed to help countries implement the 2021 recommendation on the ethics of artificial intelligence. As you know, recommendations and as normative instruments are not legally binding, but this recommendation proposes appropriate steps which UNESCO member states, including Namibia, are encouraged to apply, including legislative and other measures to give effect to the principles and norms of the recommendation. We are, UNESCO, extremely happy that Namibia has decided to undertake an assessment of its readiness for artificial intelligence. This assessment has resulted in important legal, sociocultural, scientific, educational, economic, technical, and infrastructural recommendations, which would help Namibia build the ethical framework necessary to leverage and maximize the benefits of artificial intelligence for its development, while minimizing the risks and challenges posed by the technology. As was alluded to by Dr. Mundia, Namibia is not alone in this journey. Five other countries in southern Africa are engaged in the process of assessing their readiness for artificial intelligence. Botswana, Malawi, Mozambique, South Africa, and Zimbabwe, and are at different stages in the process. This is a very important point because artificial intelligence and transformative technologies do not respect national borders. We are all interconnected, and AI has made that even more so. Consequently, harmonization or some form of alignment across neighboring countries on basic values for the ethical development, governance, and application of artificial intelligence is necessary to ensure the promotion, the protection of human rights, human dignity, and the environment. And I'm stressing environment because, as you know, artificial intelligence uses a lot of natural.
Now, getting us into the aspect in terms of some particular insights, as well as also a notion in terms of understanding in a social setting and in an everyday setting, we will quickly turn to a short break. After that, we'll be getting into interviews conducted in terms of understanding from everyday Namibians, as well as also civil society, looking at the involvement of AI in everyday scenarios. What does it actually translate to? What are some of the particular potentials, as well as also, are there any particular lagging aspects that first need to be cleared up or even achieved in terms of, firstly, realizing that full-scale or full-blown adoption of AI is the way to go? We come back right after this short break.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than The Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Coming back, dear listeners, from the extended break right there, and obviously getting into some of the particular aspects regarding the discussion that we just basically emanated or exited from, that being the aspect of the launch of the readiness report. And the readiness report, just mind you, actually takes a particular look at various particular, and I like using the word aspect, don't worry guys, various particular aspects of everyday life, as well as also overall industrial and other particular applications for the use of AI and its particular benefits. However, one of the particular scenarios that have been listed is a dimension of social and cultural usage. And this particularly gets us into the next frame, specifically the next bit of conversation, in terms of where I had the opportunity of speaking to civil society representatives, specifically that being Zoe Titus from the NMT Media Foundation, and a learner from a school, that being John. I can only identify him as John because we agreed on that particular scenario. He's still, on school itself, even though he's 18. And both of them gave unique insights in terms of everyday use or in a cultural or social setting scenario in terms of the adoption and usage of AI. We take a listen firstly to Zoe in terms of the engagement, looking at a social, cultural, at a macro level, and in terms of what particular things, firstly, probably need to be sorted out. And joining us this morning here on the Early Morning Scoop, we're joined by Zoe Titus from the NMT Media Foundation to help us engage specifically on a particular notable subject matter that stems from the launch of the AI Readiness Assessment Report that happened on Monday. And firstly, Zoe, if I can first welcome you and say good morning. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us and our listeners.
Thank you, Dwight. Wonderful to be with you.
Zoe, the question I have is particularly straightforward. AI readiness obviously takes a look at Namibia's particular involvement and adoption of this particular scenario. This is not the first time we've done a countrywide analysis, like the 4IR analysis as well, but which actually stemmed from COVID. But when we take a look specifically at one particular pillar in the AI readiness, which is based upon the aspect of everyday use, societal and cultural applications in that manner, many everyday people or lay people, if I can use the word lay persons, would already identify, but they find AI usage every day. For example, you have something on WhatsApp by Meta, you have something from Google for your daily Google searches on the internet, you've got potentially something running around if those that are ChatGPT savvy, and even more if we have time to list all those platforms. How would we look at setting a policy directive for everyday use versus everyday users already involvement and adoption of this particular technology?
Dwight, firstly, that's a very complex question. But I mean, my initial reading of the readiness report is that generally I think it's a strong starting point. But it must be complemented by what I would call a rights-based and then culturally specific or culturally anchored implementation plan. Because I think in my view, the Namibia's readiness depends not only on laws or infrastructure and skills, but also on ensuring that AI systems are trusted, that they are inclusive, and that they are reflective of our society's diversity. Mm. That speaks to the social and cultural issues that you are emphasizing and concerned with. Mm. Because, I mean, without embedding these social cultural considerations into the policy, the governance frameworks, AI adoption in general risks leaving many behind.
Yeah.
I mean, I can go into some detail if you want to speak about what, you know, potentially is missing from, I mean, my initial reading of this report.
Yeah. And obviously, it's they mention things like gender parity or gender involvement,
yeah,
rural to urban populations. But this has obviously been a particular, I don't want to say a burden, but it has been something that Namibia has been striving to reach. Because in a basic policy, well, let me take out the word policy. If we look at basic community development initiatives, internet is not always at the forefront, or even electronic devices. They're not always at the forefront of basic needs. You have more pertinent needs. How do we balance these particular discussions? Because even in Namibia, we're still combating mis and disinformation when it comes around election season.
And you see that's just the issue. If we go ahead willy-nilly pushing an AI agenda and you know, policy formulation around AI without making it relevant to our context, without making it relevant to the lived experiences and the daily needs of Namibians, then we are the perpetrators of, you know, broadening that already, you know, gaping digital divide.
Mm.
I'm one of, I mean, the advocates for community involvement. I mean, this readiness assessment was undertaken, but I think that there wasn't sufficient, for example, consultation with youth, with communities, and with civil society. You cannot convince me that our youth cannot speak to issues of AI and digital policy. They live that every day. They may not have the lingo that, you know, our policymakers would want to refer to, but they can make a very valuable contribution, and those contributions must be considered.
Exactly. Zoe, just in terms of the viewpoint, primarily, if we look at, obviously, the industrial revolutions that happened, it seems like we are, somehow we forgot 4IR's involvement, and we, you know, the world has just decided to jump and skip towards AI, even though AI is perceived as being still part of 4IR. How do we look at that particular sort of like the buzz terminology that is associated to the new trends, the new buzzes, the being part or missing out? What is it, the term fear of missing out?
FOMO.
Yeah, FOMO, the fear of missing out scenario.
Yeah.
If we look at this, does this look like just one of those particular aspects?
So, I mean, I think you can look at it from two perspectives. The perspective number one, I think, which is relevant to us in the sense that we are, let's say, at least a decade or more behind, let's say, our counterparts in the North, who have gone through these processes, have developed policies, and we have witnessed their challenges. So that gives us the opportunity to leapfrog. So that's one scenario.
Mm.
The other scenario is that AI is, it's not something that we can, you know, shut our eyes to or completely ignore. It is here, it is part of our lives. And we have to, in terms of policy and other, you know, spheres of life, we have to be responsive. So it's not a fear of missing out, it's just that We have an opportunity, based on what is happening in the broader world, to, as I said, leapfrog, and most importantly, make AI and develop AI and develop policies that are relevant to our context. Mm. Because a cut and paste scenario is not going to work, and it is going to be even more detrimental to Namibians and to Africans in general.
Exactly. So we have obviously just highlight, just before we end off, there is obviously a lot of particular discussions that are happening regarding this. There's obviously also the future of jobs that the World Economic Forum brought out at the start of the year regarding AI. But most of it has been sort of like geared towards the involvement of the tool in an economic sense. We still have to understand in a everyday cultural, everyday societal sense, even though the economics plane and the socio-cultural, they sometimes overlap with each other. Just in a short nutshell, do you believe there might be some sort of an adoption in an everyday sense, even though we might already see it? I'm not asking you to play weather woman in this scenario.
I mean, we're going to go ahead to adopt this policy, and you know, there are going to be scenarios going forward where certain jobs, but I wouldn't look at it as jobs, I would look at it as functions, become redundant. And again, that is where local contexts are important, where innovation is important. And I mean, you, Dwight, also know that we are, as media people, using AI in the newsrooms. And the only way to get around this is to make ourselves relevant and to reskill. That means that we will be making media differently. We will be developing, I mean, what's ultimately happening is that we are going to be developing new advanced information ecosystems. So I think that that is the way forward. But I know you're going to cut me off here, but I have to just push this issue. The, you know, what is a gaping issue for me is that we have yet not operationalized our Access to Information Act. And that is very, very critical when it comes to issues of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence lives on data. That's its bread and butter, water and air. We don't have a data protection law.
I actually wanted to factor that in right now because many of the other countries have a data protection that encompasses AI in some way, or they've got a cybersecurity legislation that encompasses an AI scenario. One of the sponsors of this report is the Japanese government. They actually do have data protection with a provision, as mentioned, in terms of my basic Google search research, for AI, because they recognize there's already personal data of millions of Japanese persons that will be potentially at risk. So you are right. You are right in that scenario.
And just as our Access to Information Act, for example, makes provision for the appointment of an information commissioner, hopefully, and actually the readiness report recommend that we then appoint an AI ombudsman within the Information Commissioner's office. I agree with that. I mean, there is a, the example of South Africa, where the Information Commissioner has dual mandate, also being the Data Protection Commissioner, because of these two issues that are so deeply rooted and interrelated. But I mean, another issue is, you know, open data to identify high value data sets for AI development. bridging this connectivity gap, this digital divide that I spoke about. Just promoting inclusive AI applications. We spoke about the social cultural aspects. And when it comes to culture, language is so critically important. One of the gaps, for example, is that there's no roadmap within our current readiness report that, you know, speaks to, you know, local language data sets or bias testing. So I, for example, would say let's look at a national local language AI program. There's so much that comes to the fore when we have this discussion, and I don't think that we'll be able to delve into everything in the short discussion. But again, as I said right at the beginning, this is a good starting point, but it must be complemented by a rights-based and culturally anchored implementation plan.
100%. Zoe, I'd like to thank you.
Now, just getting into or close to the last 10 minutes, we still have to factor in the second of the particular analyses and engagement, and that is ultimately talking to a learner who's, we will just call him by his first name, John, ultimately in terms of everyday use, highlighting specifically that in many cases, education, which also forms part of the societal and cultural scenario in terms of interactions, as well as also adoptions, as well as also where you see AI being permeated into or specifically seeping into that particular landscape, ultimately does impact or ultimately assist the future generations in terms of their interaction and potential to leverage whatever potential comes through from the use of AI. We take a listen to this engagement.
All right. And joining us this morning, specifically on the early morning scoop, we speak to a learner from one of Windhoek's local schools, that being DHPS. And we're talking to John, who is the learner from this particular school primarily. John, I'd like to welcome you and say good morning and thank you for taking the time to talk to us and our listeners specifically about the aspect of you and using AI on a daily basis. Welcome once again.
Thank you for having me. Not a problem.
John, if we start off from the basics in terms of looking at the everyday usage, from your earliest understanding of, you know, of when AI was rolled out, was this firstly something that you probably thought was like a couple of years away? Or was it something that you could immediately, for example, access when it became, you know, mainstream, meaning readily accessible in everyday use?
I became exposed to AI maybe a year ago or so. And even then, I wasn't really that interested. I just thought it was just a way of just degrading your brain or something.
But then
as time went on in class, a lot of them started using it, and I became curious. So here I am now.
100%. I wanted to ask, to what extent do you use, make use of AI every day? Is it like every day for your school tasks, or is it for like in your own leisure time, meaning for when you are at home or when you interact with friends or when you feel creative about a specific project?
It's kind of a mix of both, really, because at school as well, let me say I'm preparing for an exam. Mainly in math, actually, I use it. I calculate a task, and then I ask the AI chatbot. I put a prompt in to ask whether if my answer matches up, and if not, I ask him to briefly explain it step by step, and it actually helps. And I also use it in German, where you normally in literature and all that stuff, where you have to write a lot of text.
Some of the particular things when it comes to languages has been, you know, the translation mechanism. How have you found that particular mechanism?
Compared to Google Translate, I would say it's pretty worse. It's actually really bad. I wouldn't recommend using that. Not yet, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
know, it's still messing up a lot of pronunciations and stuff.
Yeah. There's an extra question associated to that particular question that I want to ask you in terms of how comfortable are you specifically that potentially the AI program is learning from what you are feeding into it? How do you feel about that particular aspect?
We actually had a presentation about this today in English about the privacy that AI is basically just this mechanism that collects info, and based on that info, it knows how to enhance your experience and everything. I think it's not really a big of a problem if it takes my personal data, so long as it maintains somewhat transparency, just shows me that it's like taking data. And plus, it's also my responsibility anyways to make sure what I'm giving this bot, because you can never be sure. So it's kind of a mix. I'm okay with it taking info.
Yeah. If I ask you in the aspect in terms of the threat potentially of what you might have heard as a learner still on school of other learners, you know, other fellow classmates and the likes potentially using it as a cheating tool, because I remember when I was back on high school, the biggest threat was obviously or the easiest cheat was that you would, you know, bring in other materials to try and copy from instead of having learned for the work. Has there been such particular threats previously that you might have observed?
Yeah, I'm not going to name anyone.
Please don't. Yeah.
But I have observed people trying to use it anyways. They would plant a device and say in the bathroom already, or if they're really bored, they'll just keep it in their pockets, and when the teacher's not looking, they'll type in a prompt. And it's not really that popular. I mean, maybe a few people would do it. So it's not really a danger whatsoever. Nobody really trusts themselves to go that far. You know.
And if you bring it down to the aspect in terms of using it outside of the educational use or outside of the educational frame, do you actually interact with it much besides a Google search, you know, Googling for something? Do you use it in any other particular everyday usage?
To be honest, I do actually use it for recommendations. So maybe when I'm home alone, I ask it to prepare a recipe for me, because I actually did it once to prepare a recipe for me to cook.
Really, John? Really? You really went that far? I don't want to judge, but you really went that far?
Yes, I did. I was hungry.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was mid, but It was an experience, actually. And also, you can just interact with it. It actually sometimes gives human responses to a certain level. But I mainly just ask it for maybe some jokes, or maybe what's the weather going to be like in the next week or so. So it's kind of helpful.
John, I'm going to jump into the next particular plane specifically of leisure, and that specifically I'm going to ask, are you any kind of leisure gamer? Do you play any particular computer games?
Yeah, somewhat. I do play games, but not really that addicted.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to ask about the addiction side of things. I'm going to ask in terms of, because AI is obviously a fundamental, sort of like a, what they call it, a challenge. You know, like the bosses that you find at every stage and the missions that you do. How do you compare the use of AI in such a scenario versus it in your everyday life, for example, like you try and ask for recommendations about everyday life, interactions and experiences and the likes?
To be honest, you're right. It's actually, I had no idea for a long time that they were using AI in such games.
You didn't know?
I didn't know. I just thought, these guys were just good at, reading my gameplay or something. Yeah. Like they coded it for every possibility.
Yeah.
But it was actually machine learning. I didn't really pay that much attention to that. I think it's okay, actually, because it's just a game anyways. But to everyday life, that's actually something personal, and it actually touches me at a certain level. So just also finding out that it also touches into, you know, when into your entertainment, your free time.
Mm.
It's starting to really spread, actually.
Mm-hmm. 100%, 100%. John, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk to us. If you still have something you wish to add that I might not have asked that you feel is still part of our conversation, you can still add that in before we say goodbye.
No, I'm good from my side. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. And that obviously does indicate some of the particular sort of like a, well, not some of it, because we technically did like a, almost a 360 degree scenario in it. You've heard predominantly a lot more about the industrial economic uses applications of AI, but the everyday interactions, the everyday particular engagements by people, whether you're on school, whether you find yourself at home every day, or in terms of just any other particular, you know, interaction that you have throughout your particular life, with regards to how this new industrial development actually interacts with your life or actually plays a function in your life, is one of the particular subject matters that always, always piques the interest of the everyday, the everyday user. Now, in that particular note, dear listeners, we've technically reached the end of our discussion or the end of this morning's programming here on your number one talk radio station. This is primarily on the early morning scoop. We're going to head into a short ad break. After the ad break, we'll be closing off and also doing our handover specifically to the Unpacking the Day, which will...
From sunrise to supper time, Namib Mills is there, feeding the nation with care, quality, and heart.
We believe food is more than nourishment. It's dignity. It's hope. It's the start of a better tomorrow.
Through sustainable production processes, job creation, and affordable, nutritious food, Namib Mills is driving economic growth one plate at a time. Because when we say feeding the nation,
we mean uplifting lives,
empowering communities, and building a future where no one is left behind.
Namib Mills, proudly Namibian,
passionately feeding the nation.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is EagleFM Namibia.
Coming back there from the extended break, dear listeners, and ultimately, well, having to sign out for this Tuesday morning session. Do remember to stay tuned for the rest of your programming in our company, as well as also anticipate the start of the next program in the company of my colleague Mike, who's ready and waiting specifically to engage with you in terms of the interesting conversations that he always brings us. On that note, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company, and we'll see each other again later today, specifically on the Home Run, where Hamid and I obviously will be getting into the nitty-gritties of this particular report. It'll be fun times and good sessions. On that note, stay tuned for the rest of your programming in our company.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the
no matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's radio station. If you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts or previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know. know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.